And good evening and welcome to Bird Calls, a new quarterly series here at Red River Radio. And coming to you live from the Knoll Foundation Studios. Tonight's program is made possible by the Knoll Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. Our program is about birds and everything from the avian world, and you can call in tonight at 800-552-8502. Again, that's 800-552-8502. And give us your calls and questions about birds. Also, if you have a photo of a bird, we would love for you to send that to us so that we can use that not only on the air tonight, but also post it on our website. The email address to send that to is rmoran@lsus.edu. That's rmoran@lsus.edu. And we'll be giving that information out throughout the evening tonight. Cliff Shackelford is our resident ornithologist here at Red River Radio, and he is ready to answer your questions about birds tonight. Cliff is currently the statewide non-game ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, a position he has had since 1997, and he has been an avid bird watcher for more than 30 years. He's also the first author of the book Hummingbirds of Texas, published in 2005 by Texas A&M University Press, and he's authored over 60 publications on birds and birding. He and his wife, Julie, and their two children live in East Texas. And Cliff, thanks for coming in again tonight.
I'm happy to be here for show number two. Hard to believe.
All right. Again, the numbers to call tonight, 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Give us your calls about birds. Anything about the avian world, Cliff will do his best to answer those questions. And again, if you have a photo to send us, we would love to see that at rmoran@lsus.edu. If it's a high quality enough photo, we'll publish it on our website as well. So I guess the first question for me to begin tonight is, this is the beginning of the migratory season for many species of birds. So those of us who are avid bird watchers are going to see a lot of the fowl coming through the area. Some are going to stop off and stay permanently. Some will be moving on to even further southern climes. Can you tell us about what we can expect during this season?
Yeah, this is the beginning of the what I call the changing of the guards. We see a lot of our breeding birds that oversummered with us that are heading out, and we're going to be replaced by birds that bred to our north that are going to winter here. And some, like you mentioned, are going to keep going, and we're having a lot of those birds pass through right now. A lot of Mississippi kites are pouring through right now, and some of those might end up in South America, which is pretty neat. Eastern kingbirds are piling up in big groups right now, and they'll end up in Central and Northern South America. So pretty interesting. And some of these birds live 8, 10, maybe more in years, and make this trip every year unaided by aircraft, and they do it on their own. It's pretty impressive.
Now, what do they tune into that one tells them it's time to go south, and then what is their directional finder?
Well, that's complex, but it's pretty much environmental cues that push them south. So if you're a insect-eating bird and you're in Canada, the first cold blast is going to tell you it's time to move. If you're a fruit eater and the fruit season's over, same thing. So there are environmental cues that get birds to head south. It's very complicated. We don't really have a total understanding or full understanding of how they do it, but we do realize from studies that they're using the stars to navigate. Most of these birds are migrating at night. Not all of them, but a lot of them are. Some use the magnetic field of the Earth, and they can detect that and use that as a basically like your GPS unit. There's a lot of unknowns, but birds are doing this without any electronics. It's pretty impressive.
Give us a call tonight at 800-552-8502. Again, that's 800-552-8502. If you have a question for Cliff Shackelford, who is our resident ornithologist here at Red River Radio, and we'll get those questions online. You can also email your questions or photos to rmoran@lsus.edu. That's rmoran@lsus.edu. We'd prefer to have you on the air, or you can call in your question and they'll write it out for me and send it in as well. but definitely we'd rather have your voice on the air if possible. So hummingbirds is your kind of area of specialty, and we're going to expect a lot of hummingbirds in this area. What can folks do to encourage, one, the hummingbirds to come into their neighborhoods and to keep them healthy and safe?
Well, this is the time of southbound passage for the ruby-throated hummingbird. That's the dominant hummingbird in our listening area. And they are going to start peaking in the next week or two, and that's when a lot of people that already know this, they put out a second, maybe even a third feeder to accommodate the flood of travelers that bred to our north that are merely stopping off like we would at a gas station to refuel. That's what these hummingbirds are doing. And so those numbers will start tapering off as the month of October goes. And usually by early November, they're pretty much done. Majority of them have passed through. What you can do is maintain your feeder if you have one. Make sure you don't wait for the birds to drain the feeder. You want to look at a calendar, and if it's been 3 or 4 days, especially in this heat, you want to change that nectar to fresh nectar. Think of it as serving curdled milk to your kids. You don't want to do that. If it's expired, dump it and start over. So another thing you can do is wildscape your yard, put out nectar-giving plants, salvias, Turk's cap, native lantanas, things like that attract hummingbirds and other pollinators, bees and butterflies, and it just adds color to your yard. It adds activity to your yard. So the feeder is one part of the equation. You know, they still need protein, and they don't get that from our feeders. So about 10 or 15% of their diet is going to be in the form of small gnats and flies. So they do a little bit of fly catching to get that protein that they need.
Give us a call at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502 if you have a question for Cliff tonight, or send your photos to rmoran@lsus.edu. If you're a bird watcher, a bird photographer, we'd love to see the birds that you've captured. Even if you know what they are, we'd just like to be able to share those photos and the splendor of our birds with other folks in the listening area. And we do have our first caller online, Sean from Henderson. Go ahead with your question. You're on Bird Calls.
Thank you. My question is about English house sparrows. I'm having a problem with them invading the bluebird nests I've put out. How do I get rid of them?
Well, you have to be pretty vigilant about it. When they start to put the wispy grasses and other nest material in there, you got to yank it out. So you can't let them finish building the nest, and you have to make it real clear that they are not wanted guests there. So if you're in a rural area, you know, that is not a protected bird because it is introduced here, as you mentioned in the name of the bird, the English sparrow. The other name is house sparrow. They're not native, so they don't have any federal or state protection. So if you're in a rural area, you can do what you need to do to remove them. But in urban areas, you just have to keep up with them and keep pulling out the nests. And after a while, they get the message.
Give us a call right now, 800-552-8502, or you can go online and send an email question to rmoran@lsus.edu. That's M-O-R-A-N-R, moran@lsus.edu. We'll be glad to get your questions online or by phone here for Bird Calls tonight with Cliff Shackelford. And we have Jay from Oakdale next. Jay, what is your question tonight on Bird Calls?
Yeah, I'd like to get some comment about ivory-billed woodpeckers and the big thicket area, and I'll hang up and just listen online.
So ivory-billed woodpeckers in the big thicket, that is something that our grandparents may have seen, but it has been a long time since an ivory-billed's been documented in the big thicket. There's a fellow by the name of John V. Dennis who found ivory-billed's in the late 60s in the big thicket. But there really hasn't been anything other than misidentifications come out of that area since that time. So I'm sorry to say it's probably a thing of the past. That's a bird that needs big real estate, big chunks of land. The big thicket is a big property. The tracks are very disjunct, and it'd be nice to connect them. They are working on that to provide corridors for a lot of species, but I'm afraid to say that I think the ivory billed is a thing of our past.
Now, describe the difference, say, between an ivory billed woodpecker woodpecker and a pileated woodpecker?
And those two are heavily mistaken. We have quite a few pileated woodpeckers. They're both large crested woodpeckers that are black and white. Males have red on the head. The differences are pretty good if you can get binoculars on them. Namely, when you see one perched and you can see the back, if it's jet black, the whole back, it's a pileated. If there are white wing patches that look like he's kind of got a white backpack on, then it's an ivory billed. There's a smaller woodpecker, red-headed woodpecker, that also has that white backpack, but he's only about the size of a blue jay. So we're talking about big birds. The pileated and ivory billed are roughly crow size, maybe not as husky or chunky as a crow, but they sure are the length of a crow.
And do they have a different call? Can you recognize them by the different calls? Because we do have the sound of a pileated woodpecker, so if you happen to hear this.
Yeah. That's the bird of the show this month we wanted to highlight. So I'm glad that Jay mentioned the ivory billed. So this is the pileated we're hearing, and the voices between the two species are vastly different. So what you just heard is something you can still hear in the listening area. They're very common, and it sounds like that last part sounds like a chicken, and kind of a click 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 click. And what's really neat is the old colloquial name. The old timers used to call that bird the Indian hen, and the Indian part came from the drumming, and the hen from that click 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 click. So I love that name because it's very descriptive and very accurate colloquial name for that bird. The ivory bill sounded very different. It sounded like a little toy trumpet, kind of a. Very, very different. So you shouldn't mistake those two if you hear them. And then if you see one, you really need to have binoculars to see the differences. If you're seeing it far and distance with the naked eye, they can look a lot alike.
All right. You are listening to Bird Calls with Cliff Shackelford, our resident ornithologist tonight. You can give us a call at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. If you have a photo of a bird and you'd like to send it to us, you can send it to rmoran@lsus.edu. We have Cora online from Nacogdoches. Cora, you're on with Bird Calls. What would you like to talk
Thank
about?
Thank you for taking my call. I have a question about whippoorwills. When I was young, like in the 1960s, I could hear them all the time. I lived in rural area of Longview. And I hadn't heard any more of them until here in Nacogdoches. Just this year, I heard one in my yard. I live just outside Nacogdoches in a kind of semi-rural area. Has there been a decline in their population or not on them?
Well, thanks for the call, Cora. I think, first of all, we need to differentiate between two sound-alikes that are both closely related. The whippoorwill is strictly a migrant in the listening area until you get up into the Ouachita Mountains of Arkansas and Oklahoma. But the bird that we have here, if it's not during migration, and if you heard your bird in, say, May, June, July, I'm pretty confident you had a chuckwill's widow. And that bird is here as a breeding bird in the listening area. It spends the summer with us. They're very noisy and can be confused with the whippoorwill, but it's just a different species. And they just don't like the lights. We put security lights out even in rural areas. We want to be able to see potential danger. So those kinds of lights don't do well with chuckwill's widows. They like real dark areas. So urban areas are void of chucks because of the lights. And they also they need big wood. So any place that's very fragmented, they don't like foraging over open fields or over open water. So it's got to be big woods that they're foraging over and very dark.
And we happen to have the sound of a whippoorwill with us here. So this would be now the chuckwill widow is slightly different. I've got a real good. Unfortunately, I don't have it with me, but I've got a great sound effect actually recorded out in a beautiful 6-acre plot, and very dark out there. So, good. And it was recorded in May in the middle of the night, too.
Okay, well, that whippoorwill you heard that we just played, it's very rolling whippoorwill, whippoorwill, whippoorwill. And let me tell you, if you're camping and that bird is right over your tent, you won't sleep because it's very loud and obnoxious. It's nice when it's in the distance. Same with the chuckwill's widow. It can drive you crazy if your tent's right under where one's singing. But it's a, and sometimes you don't hear the chuck.
Right.
And sometimes if you're at a distance, you only hear the will's widow. Yeah. Will's widow. So they're different, and so the date is very important. So we would have whippoorwills pouring through in the spring. They're vocal, and that's going to be the last week of March. First week of April is really when they peak, and then chucks come through, and then they're the ones that are the dominant songsters here.
And are whippoorwills also a nighttime primarily bird when they sing?
They're both nocturnal, yeah. So they're both going to be singing at night, yes.
Give us a call, 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502, or you can go online and send us a question or your photo of a bird to rmoran@lsus.edu. That's rmoran, M-O-R-A-N, at lsus.edu. And we do have Glenn online from Benton.
All right. Thank you very much. I live in a semi-rural area near a lake, and I have also a problem with a bluebird house. In the bluebird houses I've had here for years, bluebirds have nested in them. Don't usually have a problem. I make bluebird houses and give them away. Problem is this year, this last winter, I had flying squirrels nesting in the bluebird house. And when the bluebirds came back this year, I think the flying squirrels might have decided to eat the eggs of the bluebirds. One time the eggs were gone. Were broken up. I'm used to a snake would take the whole egg. This left the shell in there. The insides are gone. Mm-hmm. Next time I found the bluebird half eaten, the male bluebird. The only thing I can think of is flying squirrel did it. Because I know they can be semi-predatory. What do you think about it?
Well, I think one thing to consider is that there are lots of different critters that want that same apartment you've put up for bluebirds, what we call cavity nesters or cavity users, not just birds. And you mentioned one of the more important ones that in the mammal world that likes to use those boxes. So what we recommend is you put up enough of that government housing for everybody. Try to put up more than once, put up many, and then hopefully you'll accommodate all those critters in your area that want a cavity. Because a lot of people complain when they put up a bluebird box that the titmice or the chickadees are using it, and that's not what they're targeting. But we get those using our bluebird box, and we love them. There's nothing cuter than a brand new baby Carolina chickadee. They are just so cute, like they have little tuxedos on. It's hard to know what ate those birds. If you have a predator guard on your pole that your bluebird box is on, that's key. You want to have a predator guard that metal flashing that keeps rat snakes out, that keep raccoons out, keep cats out. So yeah, the flying squirrel can get around that flashing and land on the box and get in. And yes, all kinds of squirrels do like protein that you get in eggs. So there's really nothing you can do to avoid that kind of thing. Is you just have to hope that the bluebirds renest.
You are listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio, and our resident ornithologist is Cliff Shackelford, and he is taking your calls tonight at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We do have a caller online, Tim from Hallsville. Go ahead with your question tonight on Bird Calls.
Yes, good evening. My question was about woodpeckers. I actually know what a red-headed woodpecker is, but I have this very large woodpecker that I've been here 5 years and I've seen three times. He's about the size of a starling, and I just want to know if I'm hallucinating. And he makes a very interesting call that's almost like a cackle. And that's my question.
Okay. Thanks for the call, Tim. Well, the size doesn't match up with the sound that you described. The sound... that you described, that cackle, to me, sounds a lot like the pileated, but he's the one we mentioned earlier that's crow size. So starling size, actually, to me, that's a smidgen smaller than the red-headed woodpecker you mentioned. So there's also the red-bellied woodpecker. That's definitely our most widespread and most abundant woodpecker in the listening area. So if you're going by size, which is tough and tricky to do, because what you find as small, I might find as large, it's very subjective. So if you're, you know, you see it next to something of a known size and you're very confident that it was starling sized, I would look up red-bellied woodpecker. They have a zebra striped back. The males have a red mohawk. And they're pretty noisy, and they're just really common here. Red-bellied woodpecker. It's not the best name for the bird because we don't see that belly patch, because guess where it is? It's pinned up between the bird and the tree that it's holding onto. Yeah. So it's hidden from our view. But in the early days, when these birds were named to science and described, they collected it and they looked at it and said, well, what's unique about it? Well, wow, look at this red belly patch. No other woodpecker has that. So there's the name, red-bellied woodpecker.
So there's no sort of crest marking or anything like that that you could identify them by?
It doesn't. That's a crestless woodpecker. Okay. So the red belly does not have a crest. And a crest is just a fluffy top notch, something right. like a blue jay has, and they don't have that.
You are listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio, and we have our resident ornithologist with us tonight, Cliff Shackelford, and we would like for you to go ahead and give us a call at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502 with your calls tonight. We have a caller online, but I don't have a name for this gentleman, so go ahead with your call tonight on Bird Calls.
Thank you. Thanks for taking my call. I live over in the Pittsburgh, Texas area. Last Saturday morning, woke up to a bob-like quail sitting on the rail of my porch. Was he just an accidental traveler, or have they made a comeback in this part of the state?
Well, it's hard to know. We have a couple things to think about. Number one, natural occurring quail go through what we call boom and bust cycles. They come up in big numbers and then they crash. It's very dependent on rainfall and range conditions, how the grassland is. We also have a lot of people doing what's called put and take hunting. So they have cage raised quail that they release for hunting purposes, and sometimes those birds get away. So if he seemed really tame, and it does sound like he was very tame, he could have been one of those put and take quail that didn't get collected by a hunter, but he's probably going to get picked up pretty quick because of his tameness. He's used to not having things chasing him, and guess what? He tastes very good, and all the predators know that. There are a lot of avian predators, mammalian predators that are going after things that taste good, so the bobwhite that is cage-reared and released is usually toast within a few days or a few weeks. They don't make it.
You are listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio, and Cliff Shackelford is in our studio tonight. He is with the Texas Park and Wildlife Department. He's their non-game ornithologist and expert on birds, and he is with us tonight taking your calls at 800-552-8502. Again, the number to call, 800-552-8502. And if you have a photo and you'd like him to try to identify the bird at hand, give us an email at rmoran, M-O-R-A-N, rmoran, at lsus.edu. And we have a caller online, Ben from Oak Grove. You are online on Bird Calls. Give us a call right now. And go ahead, Ben.
My question was about the bull bats. I hear them sometime above parking lots at night, and I've seen a couple working in and out of a spotlight shining up a flagpole. I was wondering if they use echolocation or how they find their insects.
Okay. And the bull bat, let's talk about that name. That's the colloquial name for the common nighthawk. And they're in the group of nightjars. Another colloquial name for the group is the goat sucker, which is an interesting name because the goat farmers would see these birds flying around the goats and flying underneath and all around, and they figured, oh, they're suckling from the goats, and that's where that name goat sucker came from. But they're actually going after all the pesky insects that are around livestock. So they're actually eating insects and not suckling the milk from the goats. So your bull bat or common nighthawk is going to be a heavy migrant through this area. We have very few that stick around to breed in the listening area. There are exceptions to that, but they're not a widespread nesting bird in the piney woods here. So what else? I may have gotten off track here, Ben. What else was that answering your question, or what did you ask? I'm sorry.
They used echolocation.
Oh, that's right. You did say that. They do not. There are some birds that use echolocation. The one that's most famous and studied is a bird in Latin America called the oil bird. But the bull bat does not use echolocation. They instead, like chuckwills, widows, and whippoorwills, they're flying around at night when there's moths and other aerial insects, and they're using their large eyes to see, and they have big wide mouth gape to their beak, and little bristles that look like sharp hairs called rictal bristles, and those actually help them with tactile reception. In other words, they feel stuff. If they're not right dead on target to gobble up that moth, they can feel that they're a little left of center. They can adjust and quickly grab with their mouth. They don't use their feet to forage. They grab. They just basically suck things down, but they're not using echolocation. They're using their eyes. And that might be why some of those, like the earlier call we talked about, chuckwills, widows not liking the light, that maybe their eyes don't work well in that security light that you have in the yard. But no echolocation in bull bats, no.
You are listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio, and our resident ornithologist is Cliff Shackelford. You can give us a call at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And ask your question. If you have a photo and would like to send it in, send it to rmoran@lsus.edu. That's rmoran@lsus.edu. And we have a photo that was sent in. And Cliff, can you, and it looks like a pretty good photo. Can you go ahead and tell us what we're seeing in this photo? And we'll post it up later on our website.
It's a good photo. It was emailed to us by Eric Landrum in Nacogdoches. And it's not of a bird, but it's of a birdhouse. It's of a screech owl box, and he says, quote, he put it up about 10 feet above the ground on a pine tree facing south-southwest. It's been up about 1.5 years, but still hasn't had any takers, any suggestions. And the thing is, this is like a lot, putting up a birdhouse is a lot like hunting or fishing. It doesn't guarantee that you're going to come home with anything. So you have to just hope that you put up a box that it'll be used. But what's happening with a lot of these birds is there might already be preferred cavities that they're using. So I would say leave it and just wait, because sometimes it might take more than 3 or 4 years before it gets occupied. But it's very exciting when you do finally get an owl to use your owl box. So I would say you've done everything right. It looks good in the photograph. I would just say that maybe in the surrounding area, if you do have screech owls, which the habitat looks great, they probably already have a natural cavity in the woods that they've been using, and they'll see this. And when that tree falls down, maybe, then they'll say, "Hey, I know where another residence is to move into." So it is good to provide this for future use. It's just not, it's difficult to figure out when that might happen. So I think patience is going to be a key to this.
You are listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. Give us a call at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We have Jim from Houghton online. Jim, go ahead with your question tonight on Bird Calls.
Yes, sir. I'm in a suburb area about a half mile from a water treatment and pondment that has good colonies. It looks like of purple martins. And I'm wondering why they're still not coming to the nest that I put up. It's about 12 feet in the air at the end of a little cul-de-sac, 100 feet or so from most of the big trees. We've got quite a few big trees adjacent to ours. And wondering how long it takes to get them.
And are you saying you're still seeing the purple martins right now or in the last month or so? Or are you talking about in the springtime?
I see some that hunt around here, but none have nested.
Okay.
I've got a wooden box. We just put it up on a pole. But my neighbors also have a couple of boxes up and don't seem to have any martins.
Yeah, and then it's difficult to know how far your birds are traveling all throughout the day to forage. In other words, you could have another neighbor that has the preferred nest colony. And so those birds range a good distance every day to go out and get the insects that they require. So the thing is, not everybody that puts up a box, especially for purple martins, is going to get it. So we get a lot of people that live next door to someone that has purple martins, and they say, oh, I'm going to do this too. Well, you know what? You guys are in the same neighborhood from the perspective of the purple martin, and you're not going to get them in the human neighborhood. It's so we have to remember, in the purple martin neighborhood, you're shared among those homeowners. So what I'm guessing is that you've got someone else working at these same purple martins, and they're nesting in those boxes. You might not know where they are. But that they're using somebody else's boxes.
You are listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio, and our resident ornithologist is Cliff Shackelford. We have Jody on hold right now. We're coming up to you in just a minute, Jody. But first, we have a question, and that is, this is an online question. Where does the ringneck doves we are seeing in this area come from?
The ringneck doves that we see in great abundance now are actually called Eurasian collared doves. They have a little bit of ring around the collar. It's a black half collar on the back side of the neck, and those are, as the name suggests, Eurasian. So they are from the Palearctic region. They're not native here. They were introduced, and they have exploded. And the first record in Texas was in about 95, and it wasn't many years after that that they were in all 254 counties of Texas. So they especially do well in urban areas because of seed feeders. They like grain areas and agricultural lands where there's spillage. They just do really well in urban settings. So Eurasian collared dove. So ringneck dove is not probably not what you're seeing. It's the Eurasian collared dove from the Palearctic.
You are listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio. Our resident ornithologist is Cliff Shackelford. You can give us a call at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We have Jody online from New Orleans. Jody, what's your question tonight for Bird Calls?
Hi. I'm a beginner birder. I've been doing it for about a year. I've got good binoculars and a good camera with a zoom lens. And I was wondering if you can give me some tips on going after the smaller birds like warblers and, perching birds. I'm pretty good at ducks and geese and wading birds by now.
Okay, well, this is a good time to start looking for a lot of those smaller birds as they're southbound. What you want to do is start investigating some of the coastal woodlots in your area. And actually, when Hurricane Isidore, were you in New Orleans when Isidore hit about 10 years ago?
No, I sure wasn't.
Okay, I was there. I was at a meeting. And actually, in the middle of the meeting, it was an ornithological meeting, they said, look, this hurricane's coming. If you're going to stay, you're going to be stuck here. If you need to go, you need to go because they're about to shut the airport down. I drove there. We were on about the fifth floor of the hotel, and we waited it out. But the storm hit, and the wood, just the few scattered trees outside of the hotel in downtown New Orleans, were dripping with songbirds. I'm talking several species of warblers, vireos, tanagers, buntings. It was amazing. So find out where that hot spot woodland is, and hope for some weather. Although we don't want to wish too much for bad weather for birds, because it can be quite fatal. But these birds got caught up in the storm, and any tree would suffice, including a tree that's completely surrounded by cement and high-rises in downtown New Orleans. And I'd never seen anything like that, and it was in the fall, obviously, when Isidore hit. Other than that, I would say maybe venture a little bit farther. Maybe think about going on an hour drive, looking for hot spots where there might be a coastal woodlot, and the birds will concentrate there. And actually, the first week of October can be peak for a lot of warblers. I've done fall warbling on the Texas coast, and it is fantastic. And most birders don't want to mess with the heat and humidity and the mosquitoes. Yeah, it is bad, but I've seen 14, 15 species of warblers in a day. I can remember October 10th several years ago was a peak day. It wasn't really a weather event, but and most of those warblers were still in great breeding plumage. They weren't on that plate in the Peterson guide that he calls fall confusing warblers or confusing fall warblers. Those are usually young of the year that haven't quite obtained their breeding plumage, or they're in molt. So they are very confusing, but whoa, you can see, you know, American Red Start looking just orange and black and gorgeous, black-throated greens looking fancy. So this is a good time to look for those birds. And so again, look for a woodlot on the coast, maybe investigate the birding trail and find out where there's a place that these birds would concentrate on the coast before they head farther south.
You are listening to Bird Calls with Cliff Shackelford, our resident ornithologist, and you can give us a call at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. If you have a photo of a bird or a sound of a bird and you'd like to send it in to us, you can email it to rmoran@redriverradio.org, rmoran, M-O-R-A-N, at redriverradio.org. And I say that because we do have a sound that was sent in. A young boy caught this out in his backyard, and they would like to know what kind of bird this is. So let's go ahead and listen to this real quick.
That sounds like one of the varied calls of a tufted titmouse. That is a bird that has quite a repertoire, but I'm guessing that, and I'd like to hear a little bit more, but if that's all there is, then I'm going to say tufted titmouse. They make that high whistle, and they do that almost incessantly in the springtime and early summer. And they're a very common backyard bird. They're expected, so that sounded very good for a tufted titmouse.
So here's a project for all the parents out there who want to get their children interested in nature and ornithology, and almost every kid today has some kind of a phone with a recording device. Have them go out and hunt down these bird sounds and send them to us. They can be part of the show and also investigate their own world, and it's a great way for kids to really get out and explore nature and get their minds going on things that are, you know, that can benefit them down the road and help out.
Yeah, and I like to hear that was a submitted by a young bird watcher. I mean, that is something that is fantastic. I started at a young age in the 70s at age 9. Of course, we didn't have smartphones and didn't have all the equipment that kids have now, but I would love to be an up-and-coming birder at a young age with all this equipment, because just like this kid did, sent in a sound file. That's fantastic. So that can get very fun and addictive. I would say keep trying to record different bird sounds. That's a great way to learn your backyard birds, is to hear something and go over and look at it. Watch the mouth or the beak move. Watch the bird, and it really sticks. You start associating that view of the bird with the sound that you're hearing, and you really make that connection. So it can be the best way to learn bird sounds, is to do that. So keep up the good work.
Give us a call at 800-552-8502 and have your question ready. We have an unknown caller coming on next. I'm not sure where this is coming from. No information, but go ahead with your call. If you can hear me right now, you're on the line on Bird Calls.
Well,
that's you.
Am I the unknown caller?
You are the unknown caller. What's your name, sir?
Leon from beautiful downtown Bossier City.
Hello, Leon.
My question is about bull bats that was mentioned a bit earlier, mm-hmm. And I wanted to thank you all for sharing the knowledge with us out there.
Great.
The thing about the bull bat is that I was at the Bossier City Pier Mall about 8 o'clock in the morning a week or so ago, and this bird flew like a bull bat flies, but it was a bit smaller than I remember them being, and he had a white stripe about two-thirds of the way down his wing from his body. And I wondered if that's a different bird than the bull bat that I grew up with.
Well, It could it have been just the angle and the flapping wings that it looked like it was on the body, but the white stripe should have been on the wing. I get that a lot when I see birds when they're moving. It looks like it's one part of the body part that the color is on, but it's really not. So if you're pretty sure it was a bull bat, there isn't going to be another species in Bossier City. There's a lesser nighthawk, but you've got to go probably 300 miles west of you to pick those up. And there's really not another option I can think of. And I'm just guessing that the white, because of the movement, just looked out of place.
Well, he was a bit smaller, plus the fact that it was in the morning. I've never seen a bull bat in the morning.
Yeah, I've seen them. If they get disturbed from their roost, they will be active because they got kicked off the roost or scared. It could be that they're in migration. We have nighthawks that actually fly during the day, and you'll see them moving during daytime. So a bull bat during the daylight hours doesn't surprise me.
I see.
Yeah.
Because he moved like a bull bat. I mean, turned on a dime.
Yeah. Yeah, that's probably what it was. And if it looks smaller, maybe your glasses, your new prescription's getting a lot better.
All right. Give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. If you have a question for Cliff Shackelford, who is our resident ornithologist here at Red River Radio, he is also the non-game ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. We definitely want to thank them for allowing us to borrow Cliff for these programs here on Red River Radio. We have a call from Dennis from Leesville is online right now. Dennis, go ahead with your question tonight on bird calls.
Okay, thank you. My question's on wood ducks, and I don't know if you can answer or not if you work with that, but I've had a wood duck box up for like 5 seasons. I find little eggs where they've hatched and all, but I've never seen any baby ducks around, and I wondered if the mama, after they hatch, takes them away and hides them somewhere. Thank you very much.
Okay, well, there's a couple of things, and I work in a building with a buddy named Howard who had a similar situation, and it may be similar, but I'll mention that in case it's what's going on. Is he would see wood ducks using the box. He knew eggs were in there. He went back to check, and the eggs disappeared. Well, he later, the next year, started to dig around a little bit, very tenderly, and the mom, when she left, would cover the eggs up. So they looked like the eggs were gone, but they were just simply covered up with down feathers to keep the eggs warm. And then when those birds did hatch, it doesn't take but a couple of days at the most before they do jump out and mama takes them to water and you never see them again. So they're really good at hopping out of those boxes. Mama coaxes them out and they either have to walk to water or jump in the water depending on the placement of the box. So I think maybe what I would do is try to time it and look in the books to see how many days it takes. If you think you know when they hatch, they will hatch and take a couple days off of work and see if you can see this fascinating thing of the babies jumping out and then heading to water. Otherwise they disappear pretty quick.
You are listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You can give us a call at 800-552-8502 to send in your call to Cliff, or you can send an email to rmoran@lsus.edu, especially if you have a photo. We have a Mary on deck, and then after that, Rob and Linda, please stay on the line. We don't want to lose your calls. Just stick with us, and you are going to be on Bird Calls. First, we have a real quick question, and that is, what is the best homemade concoction for hummingbirds?
Okay, that's a great question. The best homemade concoction is very simple. You don't even need to go to the store probably to get the equipment you need because you probably have it in your kitchen already, table sugar. That's all you need, and tap water. You don't want to use any red dyes. There's no red dye in the bird's diet. There's no need to do that. We don't even know if it's very beneficial. It could be harmful to birds, hummingbirds, to put the red dye in. So if you're doing that, buying the nectar that's red, that's usually to attract the bird to add more color. Instead, get a feeder with red parts. You can also hang some red rags, red ribbons, red bandanas. That's going to be the neon sign that says, come over here. So back to the food, you want 4 parts water, 1 part sugar. Boil that up. Let it cool. Don't serve it piping hot. It's not like Starbucks coffee. And put that in the feeder after it's cooled. You can make a big batch and keep what doesn't go in the feeder in the fridge, just like you would store your milk and your juice. And then you can keep adding or replacing, because remember earlier I said you don't want to let that feeder sit with that nectar for more than a few days, especially when it's piping hot like right now. Replace it after a few days, and you have already some built or brewed. So 4 parts water, 1 part sugar, boil it, let it cool, stir it up, and then there you go. It's very simple.
But and that's because it'll ferment out there if you let it go for too long.
It definitely will ferment, and that's why if you see a hummingbird come to a feeder that hasn't been used in a while, they're going to turn their nose up to it. And that's probably a good thing. You don't want to start getting the hummingbird sick. So you don't want to replace the sweetener. Let's say you've run out of white table sugar and you think, oh, I'll use the pink stuff or honey or something else for maybe the alcohol cabinet. Uh-uh. Stick to the white table sugar. Don't use any kind of other sweetener or sweet drink. It's just not it's not correct.
Not healthy for them.
Not
so
healthy.
We have Mary online right now. Mary, go ahead with your question tonight from Gilmer on bird calls.
Well, it isn't exactly a question. I disagree in part with the idea that the nighthawks shy away from lights, because I find it fascinating to watch them at our ballparks. And now I have, from what you said earlier about those hares, understand how they could come near to a fly ball and dodge away and never quite try to catch one. But the most fascinating evening one night at a ballpark I had was the first week in October. It was a football game that was drizzly, rainy, foggy kind of thing. And the pelicans were migrating as well as the nighthawks, and the lights had confused them.
Okay, that's interesting.
And they would fly over the field and head west and get into the dark and realize that, nope, this isn't the way we want to go. They would come back by the field and head toward the square in Gilmer where there's lights around the flagpole and stuff, and then they'd reappear a little bit and then go back to the west again.
Wow.
And keep going back and forth.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, the nighthawks were feasting on those night flying moths that were going to the field lights, and there was like maybe 10 or 15 per light pole at the football field just dive bombing the heck out of it.
Neat. Well, let me clarify what I said earlier, where the chuckwills widows and the whippoorwills don't like the lights. And you are correct that the bull bat, which is the correct name, is common nighthawk. They do like the lights. So there's a difference in what I was referring to. So, yes, bull bats do like the lights around buildings, parking lots, soccer games, baseball fields, etc. What's interesting, though, is the pelicans, they typically need thermals to migrate. They're a big, heavy bird, and I'm curious what they were doing flying around in the dark or near dark. That sounds very odd for them. That's a lot of energy to flap, flap, flap when you're that big. And if you watch pelicans, they're a diurnal migrant, and they use thermals much like raptors use thermals, sandhill cranes, a lot of other those big birds. They need the assistance from those hot swirling air movements to keep them aloft. So I that's pretty neat. I'm real interested in that you saw the pelicans flying around in a condition where there were nighthawks out and the lights were on. That just sounds very peculiar. So I wonder what was going on there. So to clarify,
well, I can't easily send you pictures. I made pictures and ran them in our local newspaper. I'm a freelance photographer.
Uh-huh.
But it was on high-speed black and white negative film. And so it's not something I can quickly send to you. Email.
No, yeah, that's fine.
But you can, ma'am,
and
you can.
10 years later, I caught the pelicans again. This time, they were circling the flagpole at the courthouse where they have those upward shooting lights, and they might have helped create a semi-thermal themselves. But they were circling the flagpole in the downtown area as they were trying to work out their orientation.
Okay, that's interesting. Yeah, well, I'd like to see the pictures of those guys. And I wonder where they went down, because they definitely are not going to fly at night. I wonder where they were going to put down, and that would have been interesting, because a pelican's going to need water to get back up. So if he lands on the ground, he's in trouble. He's got to have a little bit of a running start.
And I was going to suggest that if you can have a scan of one of those photos and then send the scan to us, then we can use it on our next program. We'd be happy to do that, and we can talk about that on the next Bird Calls. You are listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. We have Linda from Shreveport online right now. Linda, what's your question tonight? Hello, Linda.
Okay. You can hear me now?
Yes, we can.
Okay, great. I live on the west end of North Cross Lake, and 3 years ago when we had that really dry summer and the lake was down, we had pools of water left, and over on the side, one evening, an afternoon, I noticed these pink birds with spoonbills.
Yes.
And they were roseated spoonbills. I looked them up in my Audubon book.
Yes, that's great that you saw those.
Do they normally range up here? We had some ibis with them as well, but they were out there just seining through those pools trying to find minnows and all kinds of stuff, and it was really cool seeing the pink birds.
Yes, we have those in the area. They're what we call post-breeding wanderers. They're nesting on the coast, but something changes. Something happens in July, and they think, let's go inland and check things out. So we get inland sightings of spoonbills and some of the ibis and wood storks that don't breed in Texas or Louisiana. Those birds are also post-breeding wanderers. In the dead of summer and late summer, you'll see those around these, what you described perfectly, is a drying body of water. And there's lots of food stuff in there for them. And so they're annual. The roseate spoonbill, what some people might think is a flamingo, is a bird that's native here, and it does occur in the dead of summer or late summer. And then by about October 1st-ish, they won't be here much longer. They usually head back south. So we're talking about a July, August, September thing is when to look for roseate spoonbills. That's the peak for wood storks and ibis, namely the dark ibis, like white-faced ibis, which they breed locally too. But that's great because, I love the roseate spoonbill. Pink bird against the blue sky when they're flying is just fantastic. Great, great bird. Good sighting.
You are listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. We have Rob online next. Rob, what is your question tonight for Bird Calls?
Hi, thank you. I have a question about robin. I noticed a couple robins in the yard a while back, and with the use of binoculars, I saw that one of them was banded. I was wondering if you could explain that process and maybe where the bands might originate from. Thank you.
What color was the band that you saw? Did you get a color on it?
It's just it was very reflective silver.
Okay. And is that unusual that your name is Rob and you're talking about a robin, huh?
Well, that's a good play there. I didn't notice that.
And we named our daughter Robin, so that's a special name to me. So Rob with Robins. That's a good question about the banding. And that's something you have to be licensed to do. And you have to do a lot of mentoring or practicing with someone who's already seasoned to get your own permit, or you can be what's called a sub-permittee. And what it does, it allows people to track those birds. So that band had a unique number on it, and when it's picked up again, we can get information on where it was when it was banded and then where it was picked up, and maybe fill in the gaps of what was going on with its movement. So the banding is to uniquely mark the bird with a unique number.
All right, we have time for one more call, maybe two, but I know we've got time for one more. Rob, you are on the line on Bird Calls tonight. What's your question? Okay, we're going to go on. Joe, you are online on Bird Calls. What's your question?
I was wondering if maybe you could help me identify. There's this little hawk at the edge of town. Shoots back and forth across the highway like he's playing chicken with the cars. And he's small with a dark gray back and either a really dark brown or black hood and a little black stripe around his eye, like a bar across his eyes. and white with kind of speckles underneath.
And he's pretty small, and he's on the road edge. I'm going to guess that that's an American kestrel. The old name is sparrowhawk, if you're looking in an old book. And they are dodging the cars, but what they're doing is they're taking advantage of the power lines and poles and fences to see stuff, and they're pouncing on large grasshoppers, maybe small rodents that are in the grass.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So American kestrel.
Right back and forth across the highway like that. I don't know, was he trying to catch stuff like bugs or something that was flying ahead of the cars or something like that?
No, he sees something in the grass, and they usually pounce on it in the grass, and it's probably a large grasshopper is what I'm guessing.
Okay.
Yeah.
But that's
American kestrel. Yep.
All right, you are listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio. Our resident ornithologist is Cliff Shackelford, and he is with the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. He is their non-game ornithologist here for the Texas Park and Wildlife Department. And Cliff, I want to thank you again for coming in tonight. This has been a lot of fun, and it's been a fast-paced show tonight. We had a lot of calls, a lot of questions, some good photos, and even one sound coming in. So that was exciting.
It was
exciting.
Fun.
So,
lots of fun.
All right. I'd like to thank everybody for calling in tonight. This has been a great show. You've been listening to Bird Calls with Cliff Shackelford, our resident ornithologist here at Red River Radio. And this program has been made possible tonight by the Knoll Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. This has been Bird Calls. Our producer tonight has been Bill Beckett with Renee Moran. Wally Derleth, Daniel Gordy, and Henry Edwards have been assisting us, along with Jeff Bryant. The audio for tonight's program will be posted on our website in the next few hours, and you can do a podcast of this as well. The address is redriverradio.org. Stay tuned. We have the news coming up in just a moment, and then fresh air right here on Red River Radio, your community-supported public broadcasting service from LSUS. This is KDAQ, Shreveport-Bossier City, KLSA Alexandria-Pineville, KBSA El Dorado-Magnolia, and KLDN Lufkin-Nacogdoches.